break out your wireframes and heat up those Git repos. We're ready to tackle topics ranging from accessibility to front-end design, user experience, and beyond. You're listening to the Drunken UX Podcast with your hosts, Michael Feenan and Aaron Hill. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, developers and designers, this is episode number 99 of the Drunken UX Podcast. I am your host, Michael Feenan. I could not be more excited because this being 99 means our next episode is number 100. And I am absolutely stoked.
I am like super stoked about this too. Like both about making 100 episodes, but also about the stuff that we're talking about in this episode and next episode. It's really exciting.
This episode, you're going to want to listen to all the way to the end. Next episode, let's just say I'm putting some announcements in my pocket that are going to be coming out there. Mm-hmm. It's really going to make into the season hard because there's only 4 more episodes after that. And I have to come up with a season finale to do then. And I'm burning all my gas here on these 2 episodes. So we're going to have to... Aaron, I have some homework for you, to say the least.
Ooh, okay.
Plan the finale for me, and it's, just all of it.
So we're doing a group project, is what you're telling me.
Yeah. Sure.
All right, I've been down this path before.
Folks, I'm super excited about this, and if you want to know how excited I am, be sure to check us out over on the social networks. If you have Twitter, if you have Facebook, we're /DrunkenUX. If you're on Instagram, it's /DrunkenUXPodcast. If you want to chat with us anytime, Discord is up and running. Just go to drunkenux.com/Discord. Well, I went to the liquor store. I have stocked up on some new scotch. I'm going to break out something particularly special for our next episode. This episode, I will be enjoying, and I'm pretty sure I have had this on the show before, but it's a Cardu 12. Cardu is a somewhat harder to find. Is that a fair? It's not easy to find. It's not like super special or anything either.
I was expecting you to describe it like the one that was technically alcohol.
Oh, no. Cardu, I enjoy.
Right? Rocks.
Yeah. On the rocks.
Yeah.
Cardu is a Speyside scotch. It's quite nice. I think of it very much like a very rich apple pie. Like, it's sweet, but not sugary. It's not sugary sweet at all. It's like a really old-fashioned, like, rich apple pie or apple cobbler. Mm. Like, when you bite into one of those apples and it's got a little bit of crunch to it, but, like, you've got that sort of soppy white fruit flavor to
it. Okay. Okay. I'm feeling you.
Little nutmeg. But it's a very fruit-forward type of scotch, which is typical for Speyside.
Mm-hmm. My drink is almost gone, actually. I've got a Cazadores and pineapple juice.
A what now?
It's tequila. It's
okay.
It's tequila reposado, so it's like aged. I'll drink it like neat, but I felt like mixing it with pineapple juice tonight.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
The right way
to drink tequila is the way you like it.
Yeah, I thought so
like
too.
Like scotch. Before we jump into our topic for this evening, which I know I have not told you yet, and that's silly because you've seen the title of the episode at this point, so you know kind of where we're going with this, but it is the start of October.
Mm-hmm.
There are 2 big things happening right now that you should definitely go and check out. The first is, and we have talked about this in past episodes, the 2021 State of CSS Survey is now open for submissions.
Oh, right.
They collect a bunch of information about what, you know, new CSS features people are using, what new-ish features, you know, in the last couple of years that have now had a little time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what have people learned? Are they using it? Are they not using it? What frameworks are they using? It is always interesting. It's a very well put together survey. It's a very in-depth survey. So it produces a lot of really good data, in my opinion.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. This is up at stateofcss.com. Mm-hmm. You do have to sign up for an account for it. It's super painless because what they do is, the survey is long. I will warn you ahead of time. It's multiple pages of lots of questions. You're probably not going to want to sit down and fill it out all in one go. I'll just warn you ahead of time. But if you have the time and you're willing to sit down and go through those questions, it is very helpful for understanding how designers are using CSS right now. Mm-hmm. But so you set up the account, and that account can save your progress that way. So that's state of CSS. Go check mm-hmm. it out. Go fill out the survey. Contribute some data to it. Even if you're new, and I should emphasize that, like, it is okay if you are a junior front-end developer or designer that you don't know anything about CSS. That data is still valuable to the survey to help understand, because one of the things they ask is how many years of experience do you have? Mm-hmm. And they chart that out to kind of show where respondents are in their journey across stuff. So even if you don't know a lot of that stuff, it's okay to go fill that survey out. So mm-hmm. check that out. Number two.
Right. So it is October, which means you should get out your computers and
I mean, they're probably out right now.
Yes. So keep them out. And if you haven't already signed up for Hacktoberfest, I believe you still can.
Yes.
The sooner you get your PRs in, the more likely you will be to get a t-shirt. They do have limited supply. I have gotten one the past 3 years, maybe 4 years now. And they're always great. I wear them proudly. And you can find lots of, there's a label for Hacktoberfest on GitHub. You can just search for that to find issues.
Oh, there. Okay. Yeah. I just use a good first issue.
Oh yeah, that too. That's also a good one. Yeah. Get your PRs in. Please do them in good faith. Don't do crappy ones. They do actually have a moderation process now, and you can get booted from Hacktoberfest indefinitely.
So remember the overlay fact sheet when we were talking mm-hmm. about that Carl Groves' little project?
Yeah.
I say little project, as if the guy is not the stalwart of the industry. He's got this site where you can go and sign your name to it to say, hey, I am an accessibility-minded designer mm-hmm. or developer. I'm going to commit to these principles. And so you go to the GitHub repo, you pull the files, you add your name to it, and you make a PR. Those don't count. And they even explicitly call that out now in the sort of rules of Hacktoberfest, that those kinds of PRs do not count towards your total.
Yeah, you have to contribute something legitimate. But thankfully, the contributions are generally small. And it's just about fostering a relationship with the open source community and to have fun with it in the process.
And there is a Discord for it.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yes. Yeah. Discord.gg/Hacktoberfest.
Nice.
So we'll throw a link to that in the show notes in case anybody wants to find that. To help, we have a couple projects we're working on. You'll learn more about these very soon, but if you go to github.com/drunkenUX, you'll find a couple repos there. We have been actively tagging some issues that are marked as good first issue. And so if you want to go grab one of those and lend a PR to it or some assistance to it, those mm-hmm. are great starting points. They are some of them are incredibly trivial, and I am intentionally leaving them out there in case somebody wants to come in. You're learning HTML, you're learning how GitHub works, whatever, and you want to take something very simple. And I've intentionally left some of those out there so that those can be grabbed. If anybody wants to take part, we would love to help you do that. So run by, it's hacktoberfest.digitalocean.com, or just Google Hacktoberfest. We'll post some stuff about it throughout the month as well. I'll share some of those issues and things. So check it out and have fun. Go make some commits. It's October.
Okay, so this is we're nearing the end of our fourth season, and we're also approaching episode 100. And I think that it's kind of neat that we have actually been kind of like zeroing in on a pretty neat concept. And we've discussed it on the show a couple times, but prior orbiting. To this, yeah, we're orbiting, like slowly, like getting closer and closer, like we're going to crash into the sun eventually. So we're like orbiting the edge of the sun right now.
It's 2021. I welcome a fiery death. Thank you very much.
From what I've known of desire, I have favor fire. So in preparation of this episode, I went through all of our previous episodes and found 24 different episodes where we were kind of like flirting with this idea, and we didn't have a name for it at the time, but we kept getting closer and closer to this kind of this intersection or nexus of like accessibility and inclusive design and like away from dark or hostile patterns. And just like this general, like, you know, almost a design philosophy, like we discussed with Greg Pudanovich way back in season two, episode 14. And
no, that would still have been one.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, 26 episodes a
season. Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. I'm thinking monthly. So when we did the talk at UX at UW, we used the phrase or the word kind design for the first time. That's the sun that we've been approaching.
Yeah.
And it's not going to kill us when we collide with it because it's a good thing. So now we're going to land on it and be in the happy place.
Yeah, it's something that we've, I think, especially recently, because when Aaron told me, hey, yeah, the first time we used that phrase was in episode 90, I'm like, that can't be right. We had to have said it earlier than that. And I went back and did a search on the website, and I'm like, nope. The first time the phrase kind design shows up in our show notes or in our transcripts is in episode 90. So it's something, though, that we have put, I think, a lot of emphasis on, especially as you've heard us use this phrase hostile design a lot. And hostile design, I think, extends from the phrase dark patterns. This is something that I think most of you will be familiar with or have heard us talk about before. There's a website, darkpatterns.org, that is pretty well known at this point. This notion of bad things, basically. Dark UX is another phrase. And we kind of, I think, came to this understanding that, you know, hostile design is the thing that surrounds dark UX, dark patterns, and inaccessible design.
Social considerations aside about like the subtext of dark versus light and all that, I think that the one of the problems with dark patterns or any of that language is that it suggests like, you know, dark or clandestine or hidden, obscured. And like all these things are like not innately bad things. Like just because something's hidden doesn't make it bad. It could just be shy. But hostile patterns applies intent. And the I think that's important, is that you're saying the person who created this thing that's unpleasant intended it to be to have that outcome. That was something they wanted. And I think that it's like you're prioritizing your needs as the content creator at the expense of the user's experience.
A good example here, just to throw it out there, and not to bring politics into any of this, but it is literally the best example of hostile design in action that we've seen in the last 4 years, is the attention that has been drawn to the RNC's, the Republican National Committee's donation page. The boxes that they include on that with language that is meant to deceive, with boxes that are meant to obfuscate their purpose, in an attempt to sneak into your cart, which is a specific dark pattern, the process of making you donate every single month, whether or not that is really what your goal is. I genuinely cannot think of a better example of hostile design in action than that right now.
I think that's a great example. And I think that the concept of kind design, which I think, you know, going back to that Greg Pudanovich episode, I feel like this is probably a design philosophy. Like this is the wellspring from which many other things, you know, like emerge from.
Right.
I think kind design sits as the antithesis of hostile design.
Yeah. They're definitely foils of each other. Yeah. I think very directly.
If you start from a place of kindness to begin with, then you'll naturally want to be accessible. You'll want to be inclusive. You'll want to have a positive user experience that your users like because you're coming from a place of kindness. And I think that that's really critical. And do you remember the Accessibe thing from, what, like a month, 2 months ago? They created a product that would ostensibly help kind of do turnkey accessibility for websites.
That overlay fact sheet that we mentioned earlier, that sprung out of this. Accessibility is what is called an accessibility overlay.
Okay.
What is an overlay meant to do? It's meant to cover things, right?
I think the accessibility thing, writ large, is a good example of how you could do accessibility without having it come from a place of kindness. And it's the same kind of thing if you have a company that maybe they're just checking the box, like, okay, we're technically accessible per this audit that we had, so we're done. And that's accessibility, but not kind accessibility. If you're doing kind accessibility, you're starting with how are our users, like listening to your users, having empathy for users, and then trying to meet that and do the best you can. And I think that's where you want to be. Their product itself wasn't attempted hostility. But it didn't come from kindness, though. It came from like moneyed interests, or like they're trying to make a product to sell, which whatever. I mean, I'm not judging that, but they're doing it where they're prioritizing their own product and their own profits and their own needs against or at the expense of the users that are using it.
In the messaging, in the wording, in the responses, if you go back, listen, I don't remember which episode it was where it came up, but do a search on our site, you'll find it, where we talked about this. And what strikes me is this notion of, you know, where kind design starts, one of the first things that I think has to come out of that is your intent. The same way hostile design brings with it an intent to treat the user as a hostile witness on the stand, so to speak. And kind design implies things like when somebody comes to you and says there is a problem, you listen. And you do something about it. And when users came out of the woodwork during this whole affair and started saying, here are the ways this tool affects me negatively as somebody with, you know, various accessibility needs on a website, and their response to that was, well, we're not the ones who are wrong. You're wrong.
Right.
You know, what's the Simpsons, the principal? Maybe like, the kids are the kids wrong? No.
The kids who are the ones who are wrong.
The kids are the ones who are wrong. Yeah. It was that kind of thing. And that's where you can draw the line in the sand and say, okay, you're not practicing kind design. Because one, and we're going to get into this and talk about like what makes up kind design. And there are steps. There are actionable things that you can write down. And one of those things is listening and responding to user needs. Now, how you do that depends kind of where in kind design you fall. There are many ways that you can respond to that. But throwing it away and saying, we're going to keep doing what we're doing and not make our product better in the face of legitimate criticism, you lost the game.
Well, in episode 63, which I was in, I think it was in Chicago when you recorded that one with EJ Mason and Ruben Nick. They're from Webflow, and they were on the show to talk about accessibility. And they were both, they were really like, you know, as close to the metal as you could possibly be. But in that episode, they talked about the like how accessibility is a process in motion. Working to provide accessibility is a process in motion. It's not an endpoint. It's something that you are like, you're probably not going to get it right the first time, and that's okay. And it's just like, you always want it to be better, and you want it to be providing as much parity in experience as possible. And that's the attitude that you want to have, and not just checking the box like Domino's did with the lawsuit, right?
At this point, right, is it fair to say, and this, let me tie into like one of those clickbait things, right? Waterfall is dead.
It's not. Can I say it? No.
It's not. But
it should be.
Waterfall methodology in general, and now if you're not familiar, like there are different ideas about how you create a product, right, and how you maintain that. Agile is kind of the one that everybody sort of has in one flavor or another.
So hold on. Before you go any further, I want to say Waterfall nominally may be dead, but Waterfall has put on agile clothing and is masquerading around as agile now, because I definitely have been on Waterfall projects that were not called Waterfall. They were called Agile, but they were Waterfall.
Yeah, yeah. So what Waterfall does is it's a series of steps. There are five steps that you go through. You do requirements building, design, implementation, verification and testing, and then deployment and maintenance. And then you are done.
Mm-hmm.
There is no cycle to it. That deployment and maintenance step is sort of vague and unencompassing, and it doesn't ever mean that you necessarily start over.
Mm-hmm.
So Waterfall in general is, I think, a method that has outlived its usefulness in our industry. Everything now, while even, and what we're going to talk about here is not necessarily agile, the thing that makes agile valuable is the notion that it is a cycle. So just like you say, accessibility is not a goal, it is a process. You're always working on it. Why are you always working on it? Because technology is always changing. We have, you know, voiceover technology now that we didn't have 10 and 15 years ago. We have, you know, assistive technology for motor skills that we didn't have, you know, back when we first started building these websites. Technology changes, so process changes. And engaging in these cycles of development is what helps you do this. So this will be a refrain that you hear, not just in this episode, but anytime you're talking to people about good web design, good web app design. The ones that are really successful are the ones who have this sort of cycle that goes over and over and over, because that's how you do this right.
Mm-hmm.
So let's dig in on this a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Kind design is an umbrella. And the reason, like, to kind of give you some scope on what Aaron did, he went out and he found 24 of our episodes. 24 episodes is a full quarter of our shows at this point.
And that's not including the RTOs and build processes,
right,
where we also discussed it.
Which I'm too lazy to keep producing.
Well, we're still not paid for this, so I don't fault you for that.
True.
These are just the Drunken UX proper episodes.
Drunken UX episodes, one in every four episodes, talked about something that falls under this umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
But we get into things, and the phrases that we've used in the past, we said episode 90 was where the words kind design finally came out.
Mm-hmm.
What you may have heard before that were things like universal design, accessible design, inclusive design.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe it's important to take a second and understand what those are, because it's easy to say, well, aren't, you know, why do we have three names for the same thing? And why are you just calling it kind design? Are you, you know, why? So you're just trying to game some, you know, make, we're trying to make fetch a thing. Can I say that? Is that, is
yeah,
that a,
that's, I'm sure our audience will get that.
Is that a reference that I'm too old to make now? I don't know.
You're not too old to make it. I think you're in the right demographic.
Okay. Yeah. So we're not trying to make fetch a thing, for what it's worth. Universal design. Let's start there, right? Because this is one that you probably have heard of. Maybe you haven't heard of, but it has, I think, the longest lineage. Where does universal design come from? You're going to see it if you start researching back in it. It's a very architecturally focused discipline. Industrial design was big on the universal design process. Like, this came out of the analog world, and it was picked up, and we've started applying it to the web. And similar, you know, this is where what we're going to be talking about here is similar to, well, are you using BEM or Atomic CSS or Tachyons? And it's like, they're all conventions, and they're all ways to help you write CSS better. There are some things about them that are similar. There are some things that are somewhat different, but they all have a similar goal. They're all a set of conventions. And that's why Aaron had said, like, kind design is sort of the philosophy. It's the thing that ties these together. These individual practices.
It's the starting point. Like, it's the
motivation.
When you're making any decision about something that you want to do, a tool or a strategy you want to adopt or anything, you can ask, you can begin with the premise of, like, am I being kind by doing this?
Am I being kind?
Yeah. Yeah. And then that will inform your decision. Pretty much any, because the product you're making is ultimately going to collide with another human at some point, then this will always be a question that you can ask, and it should inform your decision. Even if you work in DevOps and the stuff that you're doing doesn't directly impact the users, sort of. I mean, I guess you could pull the A record and then take all of your sites down.
Ayo. Who would do that? Who on what planet would somebody delete the A and triple A records for their DNS? I mean, come on.
That's the most important thing. Like, I don't care how you make your money in your company. Like, great for you. You know, you're making profits, et cetera, et cetera. But you should never do that at the expense of treating your users as hostile parties. It's never acceptable. I don't care what your product is. Never okay.
There is a fourth spoke to this wheel that what you just said made me realize we didn't put it in the notes. And the fact that I missed this really says a lot about me. Ethical design also falls into this.
Yeah.
Because that's where, like, what you were just talking about, you know, the art of data collection and data privacy deals in kind design, but also ethical design helps you actually outline the steps and processes by which you will say, here is the data we will collect, here's how we will review it, here's how we will get rid of it when we are done with it.
All right, so that's a brilliant segue into one of the things I wrote in the doc here, which was, we had that episode 36 where we talked about GDPR, right?
Yes.
The
one of two or three episodes on GDPR.
New product design resolution of Europe. That's what that means, right?
Yeah, let's say that.
So GDPR is saying that if you live in Europe, you have certain rights to privacy. Basically, you have the right to be forgotten. You can say, company, I want you to pretend you've never met. We're breaking up for good. And they have to be able to abide by that. There's a lot more to it than that. But if you come from a place of kindness when you're building your product and you know, okay, my users, well, A, I don't want to retain data about my users that maybe they wouldn't be comfortable with me having. B, I want my users to have the agency and ability to remove themselves if they decide they don't want to be part of my community anymore. If you start with both those premises, then GDPR is nothing, because you can just say, like, oh, well, we don't collect data on them. Oh, wait, we collect this one thing. Hold on. It's gone. And our users can already back out anytime they want, and we don't retain data on them. You're already there. There's like a real, like, a business benefit. If you aren't able to see this from the point of empathy for your users, there's a business benefit to this, because if you come at it from this angle, you won't get audited for accessibility. Or if you do, you'll already be halfway done with whatever they come up with.
This actually leans also into what you were saying about, like, the notion of, hey, I can check the boxes of accessibility, but not be exercising kind design. You can check the boxes of GDPR and meet their requirements and not be exercising privacy. If you are working in kind design and you are looking at something like GDPR, the first question you're going to ask is, well, why would I give more rights to the people in Europe than my users in America? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Why don't I just build to that standard? Because everybody deserves that power over their data, over their profiles, whatever your extent is in that case. Kind design says, let's give this, democratize this and give it to all of our users, and not just say, we're going to cut out half of our users because only EU technically needs this. Okay.
If you want a fun experiment, go use a VPN, set your origin point to Germany, and go look at Twitter and search for alt-right content and look at how different the experience is, because Twitter will filter out anything that's references like the Third Reich or Nazi Party or anything, because they're not allowed to show that content in Germany. They have the capability to do this, but they only worry about it for Germany. I don't mean to invoke Godwin's law with that. It's just the thing that exists.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
So right now, or this week rather, Frances Haugen, the former Facebook employee who worked on the Civility Committee, she gave her testimony to the Senate. And some of the stuff that has come out is that Facebook repeatedly knew internally that they were doing things that were kind of shitty. They knew that they had content that was sharing negative stuff, and they knew that it was negatively impacting their users. They knew that Instagram was negatively affecting their teenage audiences, particularly women or girls, and they did nothing about it. Or they would consistently choose, like, their comparison I heard was on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is doing nothing and 5 was doing the most possible, even if it hurts profits a little bit. Not all, just a little bit. They would always choose 1. They wouldn't even go in the middle. They would be like, we're always going to maximize profits at every angle. That is hostile. That is not this.
I can't think of a more hostile way to demonstrate this practice when you have a choice between doing something and doing nothing at what amounts to no cost to you.
Right.
And you choose nothing.
Or a minimal cost. I heard a comparison that it was like, if they chose to do these things that would have a significant effect. So if they chose to be on the 5 side of that 1 to 5 scale, then maybe they make 10% less money this quarter. But it would reduce, we'll say, 75% of the problem, right?
Yeah.
And whereas if they don't do it, then they keep that 10%, but the problem persists entirely. Like, it's not a good cost benefit thing. And I don't want to make this episode about Facebook. I'm not going
to. No. Believe me, I have plenty more to talk about. Let me get you off Facebook. Yeah. Can I do that?
Yeah, please.
How about we talk about Google? That better? Is that? There is a reason why I do bring that up, though, because like Facebook, we're talking about a giant corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Google. What was one of Google's founding principles?
Oh, right. Do no evil.
Do no evil. And
which mysteriously disappeared.
That goes away.
Yeah.
Goes away.
That seems like something that like it requires so little service, and you could so easily be like, oh yeah, like we're still technically not doing evil, right? Like,
and certainly in the years, because they didn't pull it out until I think it was 2018. And certainly before 2018, they were engaging in practices that would be considered evil by many. And that's, I'm not going to argue that. What I am going to say is, don't be evil is a great motto if you are going to practice kind design. Because again, like hostile design, evil is diametrically opposed to kindness. And so by removing that, it's taking down an artificial wall that just says, yeah, we can be a little evil.
Don't be evil should be like as, like, ubiquitous and implied as saying, like, show up to work every day that you're supposed to, you know? I'm not even saying show up, like, on the dot or on time. I'm just being like, just show up to work. If you can't say that you're going to show up to work on the days you're scheduled, like, what the hell, you know?
So, universal design, I mentioned, is this principle that comes from architecture and industrial design. Mm-hmm. And it's a system. It is a literal system by which there are principles. It involves equitable use, flexibility in use, simple and intuitive, perceptible information, tolerance for error, low physical effort, and space and size for approach and use. That last one especially, you can see like the notion of curb cuts, elevators, ramps, you know, having space.
Having your buttons and icons being large enough on your web page. Yeah.
So size and space is kind of one of those. But yes, as it applies to digital, then we think about things like the new WCAG 3 that says now, you know, if you've got something clickable, it needs to be 44 pixels by 44 pixels. We want to make sure it's big enough that we get outside of the precision error problem. So universal design comes at this with this set of like, here's how you practice universal design.
Yeah, I think that like, there's always going to be situations where maybe you can't do things like the way that you want to. Like, let's say that, you know, the Wii Cat guidelines say 44 by 44 pixels. And for whatever reason on your site, you absolutely can do 44 by 44. You can only do 40 by 40.
Or you're retrofitting, maybe. Maybe you've come in after the fact. You're not dealing with something you're building from scratch. Right. You're building with something that was built 10 years ago, and you're trying to improve it.
Right. And so, like, you don't have the full space to do all 44 pixels. You can only do 40. And I think that recognizing, okay, like, we want to do this. This is what we can do for now. And understanding and accepting that, like, you're not quite hitting the mark on that, I think is important part of adopting this philosophy, because right. you're saying like, you're accepting the cost of, or like, you're accepting that you had a failure here, and that at some later point, maybe you can help make good on that.
And that's where I think we get into these two other three, if you include the ethical side, these other design patterns. Universal design is meant to produce an output. One thing, coming from where it comes from, that thought was, I have produced a building that is accessible, you know, that is universally usable. I have produced a product. You know, I can't make three versions of the product. I can't build three versions of the building. I have to build one thing that adapts to all of these things. Mm-hmm. We aren't confined by that in the digital space, though. This is where we get into inclusive design. Now, inclusive design is where we get into the cycle. We start thinking in cycles, right? Once you've built a building is a waterfall. You build the building is done, and then you get into deployment and maintenance. You don't re-architect the whole building. I mean, some people do. Obviously, that's what a remodel is. But generally speaking, that is a labor-intensive
process. Usually don't tear the building down and rebuild it. Yeah.
So with inclusive design, you get into the cycle of what they call managing. So what should we do next? Exploring. What are those needs? Creating. How can the needs be met? And then evaluating. How well are the needs met? And that becomes a cycle of process that you do over and over.
In episode 88, we had Varun Murugesan on. Hope I said his name right. I'm apologize. You did not. I didn't. Sorry, Varun. but he was here talking to us about, like, kind of the process of researching and applying UX. Yeah. And I think that same kind of attitude is sort of what you were just talking
about. Yes. Research is key, both in inclusive design and accessible design. The research is the piece.
Yeah. It's a continuous process. You're not hitting a goalpost and then ending. There should always be kind of like reconsumption, reevaluation, and assessment that's happening regularly.
You have to always, again, because the technology changes, the users change. Mm-hmm. You have to always be talking to them, working with them, seeing how things work. There's one of my favorites. So inclusive design differs from accessible design. Let me see if I can mash these two topics together into one coherently. Accessible design is easy. Accessible design is about dealing with people who need to have different accommodations for different needs. Mm-hmm. That then breaks down into our series of checkboxes, right? We need to meet certain requirements in order to make sure that we're dealing with people with low vision, people with motor control, people with cognitive limitations, and more. But that list is a pretty finite list. It's something we can test. It's something we can experiment with. And generally, accessible design is usually termed usable design, because by doing all of those things, you're inherently making it better for everybody else as well. Inclusive design deals with all of that. Inclusive design is pretty encompassing of accessible design, but it also takes into account things like cultural differences.
Okay.
So, and where we get into this notion of it being a process, right? If you have a well-designed site that has inclusive design at its heart, it would have somewhere in the area of 6,000 to almost 7,000 different translations.
Wow.
Because inclusive design thinks about things like other cultures, other languages, mm-hmm. and making sure those are accommodated in your mm-hmm. design as well. I have a really great example of inclusive design that is also okay. a really great example of exclusive design.
Okay.
If children, if you would turn to page. Oh crap! Google Docs doesn't give me a page. Turn to the last page in the show notes doc. There is a screenshot waiting for you there, Aaron.
I can't see it.
Well, why can't you see it? It's the show notes.
No, they
well, I know they can't see it, but you can.
Yeah.
I'm asking you. Yeah. This is your quiz.
I'm not a child.
Yeah. If you shaved that beard off, I would be hard pressed to think you were over 12.
I'm still tall.
I'm showing Aaron a screenshot. This is a screenshot from exorcism.io. We've talked about Exorcism many times. Fantastic learning platform. They just launched version 3. In one of our past episodes, we were talking about that launch. This is from their new profile. And so they've got this little pop-up, or not a pop-up, a section in your profile settings mm-hmm. where you can add in your pronouns.
Mm-hmm.
Now, accessible design would not care about this. This is not something that mm-hmm. would fall into the area of accessible design. It meets no criteria. It meets no checkbox. But sure. inclusive design says, hey, a lot of people really prefer being referred to a lot of different ways. And they have put this fantastic little box. A, it's great because it's ad libs. Mad libs?
Yeah.
Mad libs is the phrase I'm thinking of.
Mad libs.
Nielsen Norman did some research on this and found that like Mad Lib style forms have mm-hmm. a significantly better fill rate than line by line forms, which is interesting.
I've heard that. I have some friends who did some apps with that kind of style.
What they've done is given you a series of three sentences. Feenan mm-hmm. was really great. And then there's a box. He mm-hmm. answered all my questions. I'll recommend another blank him to others because another blank his advice was very helpful. Mm-hmm. And I can put in there, A, they give me some the frequency. I could change mm-hmm. to feminine pronouns. Mm-hmm. I can change to third person plural pronouns, whatever, and it'll autofill. Or I can put in whatever I'm comfortable with.
Sure.
That way their system refers to me the right way. Their emails will refer to me in the right way.
Right.
It costs them nothing. And this, again, to go to the political side of kind design, right? I know there are a lot of folks who have political beliefs, who have personal beliefs that this is a silly thing.
Right.
You're allowed to believe that. It also costs you nothing.
You can click the she, her, or he, him, his.
Right.
Wait, like just as easily as ignoring the rest of them.
Even if you're the person building it. Yes, mm-hmm. it'll take a couple hours of your dev time to build this in.
Sure.
But the thing about kind design is getting out of your own head and thinking about what would be nice for them.
Yeah.
And if somebody prefers to be referred to another way, this is a great tool. So would you agree with me this is a great example of good, inclusive design that's well-designed on top of it?
All the fields can be manually edited if you wanted.
All of them can be manually edited. Yeah. You can type in what you want.
Yeah.
So why is this exclusive design?
I honestly don't know. I was trying to figure out where you were going with this.
I meant to prep you before we got into this because I was like, no, cool. I should give him the answer so that I don't put him on the spot. No,
gotcha me. It's cool.
He, him, his. It's a very English version of referring to pronouns, is it not?
Yeah. Okay. So it doesn't use other languages.
What if I'm Japanese?
Yeah. It's not localized.
What if I'm Egyptian?
So I think that this would go back to the concept of it being a process.
Right.
So this is a good first pass. And then, you know, just don't see it as having checked the box and see it as we did this thing and this is a great improvement. How can we make it better? What more people can we serve with this?
And inclusive design would say, what should we do next? And mm-hmm. somebody may say, we need to make sure that we support multiple different language structures for this.
Mm-hmm.
Because not everybody speaks a Latin-based,
mm-hmm.
English-centric language. Mm-hmm. How can that need be met? Well, we give them a language selector in their profile that lets them switch to different localized versions of our system. How well are those needs met? Well, right now, and I'm going to apologize in advance to Exorcism, but I didn't see a way currently to change that.
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment, we would say, well, that need is not being met well currently. But as we design this new feature and this new way of doing it here, you know, we think it would be much better.
I would be willing to wager that if you brought that feedback to them, they would say, that's a great idea.
Thank absolutely. You. I would not be
able to do this.
And they have a diverse enough audience and group mm-hmm. of contributors that it probably has come up.
If it's not already in the backlog. I mean, I would not be surprised.
What's MVP, right? What can we get out the door mm-hmm. now and then iterate on? Like that doesn't make you not kind. If you try to deliver everything at day one, you will never deliver anything ever. You cannot deliver perfection.
Yeah, you still have to ship.
You still have to ship.
That's what I was saying before about the 40 pixel thing. Like, if you accept, like, okay, like, I didn't meet the mark here, but I know that I didn't, and, like, I want to make this better, then you will eventually get, you'll move closer in that direction. But it's all about the process originating from a place of wanting to be kind to your audience.
Yeah.
I think, can I go really quickly, go back to episodes 33, where you talked with Brian Olendyke, and then, did I say his name right?
Olendyke, yeah. He was Olendyke. Our expert on web components. He built, not by himself, he's got a great group of folks who work with him, the Hax CMS and the Hax editor.
Yes.
It's a block editor that is sort of a direct foil to Gutenberg, but works in web components. It's highly accessible, accessibility first in
yes.
the system.
Well, so that's what I wanted to bring up. Like, so him and then Ruben and EJ, and also when we discussed the US web design service or web design system.
Yeah.
USWDS. And then also, I missed this episode. I was out of town again, but when you had Christopher Schmidt, rest in peace.
Yeah.
But all of these people, though, their product was built with accessibility or with just inclusiveness in mind from the beginning. Like, this was like, we're going to address this from the get-go as part of the DNA of our product.
And you've made me sad, for what it's worth. And what? Christopher Schmidt was a man, he was dedicated to his craft. He believed mm-hmm. in education, the importance of, you know, leading from the front of this industry, accessible design, inclusive design was very important to him. If you're not familiar with him, he's got a lot of stuff out there to remember him by. So please go read it and learn from him, because he may be gone, but his impact is far from gone.
Yeah. I think that all of these people that we've had on this show so far, and many others that we haven't had on the show, they approach their creation process from this place, from this wellspring of kindness, and it makes a better product, and they make better decisions for it that they don't have to go back and change later.
Can I give you your Twitter bite, your retweet bite? Kind design means never having to say you're sorry. You should never have to apologize for work that you did if you were operating kindly. Now, you may have to say, hey, this work wasn't necessary, or this work has changed. You know, the technology has changed and it's no longer useful for our users. But you never have to apologize for it.
I was going to say at first that, like, I mean, you should be willing to apologize and everything. But I kind of think you're right, because when I think about what if someone brought feedback to me where it was like, oh, hey, I was using your thing and it was very difficult, you know, because of this or that. I think, you know, maybe you say sorry. But I think the bigger thing is you would probably say thank you, because now you have more information on how to make it better. And that kind of criticism is good. Right?
Yeah, yeah. It's always possible that you focus on the wrong thing. Like, I could see a situation mm-hmm. where a user comes with a complaint, and mm-hmm. you may read into it too far and think that that complaint reflected a bigger problem, and you spent time fixing that problem, and it turns out it wasn't really an issue. And you may have to say, I'm sorry I spent the time on that. I didn't research it enough. I should have talked to more users. And you say you're sorry to the business for that.
Sure.
But that's not apologizing for listening to the user or taking their complaint seriously.
Right. I mean, maybe you've got like a new version of a product that you're doing and you have a conference coming up really soon and you really want to launch your product before, like at the conference with the new version. But like someone brings up some accessibility concerns and you're just like, oh man, well, what are we going to do about this? You probably don't want to ignore those, right? You probably want to actually deal with
There's them. Always a baseline that you need to hit, certainly.
Right.
There's a really great, and this is related to nothing, but I just wanted to go out of my way to say it. there is actually a subreddit for hostile architecture. Like, that is a subreddit.
Oh.
And there, all right, I want to join there is one. A post called The Opposite of Hostile. And I saw it, and it's what made me think of, like, why we say kind design is the opposite of hostile design. And what it is somebody designed a wastebasket. Your average everyday park wastebasket.
Okay.
But around the edge of it are cup holders. And you may say, why would I ever want to use a trash can as a cup holder? And the answer is so that homeless people can take your cans and bottles and exchange them for money so that they don't have to dig through the trash to get the cans and the bottles out.
I think the only thing I'm looking at the picture right now, the only thing I don't like about it is that it only has spots for five.
Yeah. They could have done it all the way around. It could have been better.
Yeah.
But maybe that's the iteration, right?
Yeah.
Maybe this was a quick, like somebody thought of it at the last minute, spot welded it on and said, you know what? The next version of these, though, we're coming out with all the way around, baby.
I like where this is coming from. It reminds me also of the Bad UI Battles subreddit, which I discovered recently. And man, that is great. It's I mean, these are like bad UIs that are intentionally designed to be bad.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's always fun to see like the ways that someone can be like the biggest fuck you to user possible. Like, this is a new level of hostility here.
I've realized now there was a whole vein of research I didn't do for this episode that I should have done because I realized when I start thinking about architecture, if you want to understand the difference between kind and hostile design, there are so many examples in architecture, especially when it comes to people who are currently looking for somewhere to stay. And so you think about things like new park benches with extra armrests. Look, you now have armrests on both sides and in the middle. Yeah, you do.
That's not what that's for.
And that's also designed to make sure that people can't sleep on them. Or the spikes, you know, that everybody has seen the pictures of the spikes that they put like in entryways to stop the quote unquote birds. And it's like, no, that's not what those are there for. That is hostile design.
I found one for a basketball hoop lock, and it's just a crossbar of metal that's it's locked on top of the basketball, so the basketball can't go through it. Like, what? That's, like, that's not even, that's just so fucked up, man. Like, you're like, no.
Fold-up benches are a thing, so that, like, at night, they'll fold up the benches and lock them, again, so people can't sleep on them. There are a lot of examples of. In fact, as I'm talking here and I pull up the subreddit and I realize, wow, there are a lot of benches. We are like obsessed with keeping people off of benches.
That's kind of what I was saying earlier, though. Like kindness is political.
It is. Yes, it absolutely is.
Because when you're prioritizing maximizing your profits, like that you are going to have to make unkind decision. And being kind effectively becomes a political act.
I'm going to disagree.
If you're truly maximizing your profits, if you are truly maximizing them, you will have to make sacrifices with your user at the expense of your users.
I would rephrase. I know where you're coming from, and I don't disagree with where you're coming from. The way I would rephrase that, though, is we are a culture obsessed with sacrificing long-term for short-term.
Oh, yeah.
Like that, that's what that is, because there are, and let's extend the homeless metaphor here.
Sure.
There is an absolute treasure trove of research that says dealing with the homeless problem directly by doing things like giving them a home, you know, the tiny home movement and all of this. Yes, you're going to spend, you know, $25,000 per home or whatever to put them up. And there is research all over the place that says, yeah, and that's money that saves you a ton over the long term because you aren't spending money in all of these other areas.
You're correct. I'm referring to maximizing in the short term.
Yeah, yeah. I got where you were kind of coming from there. Like we only look at this like, how do I make sure I stay in the green right now?
The local maximum, you know, for your current fiscal year rather than the overall like integral of your profits over long time. That's what I'm referring to.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay.
We are not all on a different page here.
Right.
So this is kind design. This is where we are coming from and something that has been very close to us. And you're going to hear a lot more. I hope that this is not boring to you because this is a drumbeat we are going to hit over and over, especially as we go into season 5. And there are other things that you're going to see that will reinforce it.
I like that we have a name for it.
I like that we have a name.
Because we have been talking about it for a long time, and we just haven't known what it was that we were approaching.
Yeah.
And it feels like we like finally kind of sorted that out.
And it can be confusing when you see all these other phrases. Well, okay, wait, am I doing universal design? Am I doing inclusive design? But I got to do accessible design, but maybe I should be looking at this book on ethical design.
I think universal design is a lot more practical, like in giving
absolutely
specific advice on like on strategy or tactics. And kind design is just really going back to that origin point. Where are you coming from? What is driving you to create? What is driving you to produce? That's where this is like kind of the inception point from which your creations, you know, will emerge.
Yeah. So I hope that was fun for you. I hope that it was interesting. I hope that you practice it. I really hope you have questions. If after all of this you don't have a single question, take a few seconds. We're all going to take a breath.
I'm holding mine.
And think about what you want to ask us.
I'm holding my breath. So, when you have your questions... or just if you have comments, I don't know, like, please engage with us about this.
Are we not the first to this? Because I feel like there's no possible way we are the first to think of the phrase kind design.
I don't know, honestly. And I mean, if other people out there have like come to this conclusion as well, like I would love to talk about this some more. This is really like, I mean, growing up, Mr. Rogers was like someone I saw on television a lot. And to this day is still... like a person that I like very much admire. And I think that the way that he approaches things is something that like, I will never be like, it's so hard to get to that level of like patience and kindness, but I really aspire to like, it's definitely an aspiration.
Can I disappoint you?
Sure.
Kind design is a thing. Can I tell you what it is?
Yeah.
It's the original Colorado clothing brand geared towards outdoor enthusiasts.
Oh, well, maybe
not a sponsor. Not a sponsor.
Yeah, yeah.
I just go.
So we're not referring to...
We're not referring to the clothing brand.
Yeah. You should... engage with us. Like, I really want to hear what you think about this. You can catch us on the Twitter and the Facebox.com, assuming it's up ever again, /DrunkenUX, and on Instagram.com, if that's up, at DrunkenUX Podcast. And come talk with us and share your thoughts and everything at drunkennewx.com/discord.
And folks, if you want to get in, there's one resource I didn't mention in terms of kind design that does exist out there that can help you get a kickstart on it, get you ahead of the game and like really thinking about the best way to practice it. And that is to keep your personas close and your users closer. Bye bye.
Bye.